world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. Hi, I'm Sharon Opetisano. We appreciate very much hearing the news and commentary daily from a Christian perspective and hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. What does the Supreme Court tell us about feminism? We talked to Professor Katie McCoy about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Amy Coney Barrett.
That's ahead on Culture Friday. Plus, an extremely popular new show that has audiences saying, wax on, wax off again.
My dad died when I was 8. Mr. Miyagi was like a father to me. It's crazy, man. Both finding karate role models.
And your listener feedback.
It's Friday, September 25th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Good morning.
Now news. Here's Kent Covington.
President Trump highlighted his vision for America's health care system while stumping in North Carolina Thursday.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
Speaking to supporters in Charlotte, Trump again stated his desire to replace Obamacare with a GOP-authored plan. But he said his administration has improved the Affordable Care Act, doing away with its most unpopular provision, the individual health insurance mandate. But he also committed to keeping the most popular part of the law.
The historic action I'm taking today includes the first ever executive order to affirm it is the official policy of the United States government to protect patients with pre-existing conditions. So we're making that official.
The president said he was also signing executive orders aimed at preventing surprise medical bills, among other things. And he highlighted a new regulation to allow pharmacies and states to buy prescription drugs from Canada at a lower cost. He also vowed to mail prescription drug cards worth $200 each to more than 30 million Medicare recipients. Critics slammed that announcement as a naked political maneuver to curry favor with seniors. Minutes after Trump left the podium, Democratic rival Joe Biden tweeted, quote, "The Trump administration says the entire ACA must fall. They're arguing to strip millions of Americans of health care in the middle of a pandemic. We can't let them win." Lawmakers from both parties assured the public on Thursday that there will be a peaceful transfer of power if Joe Biden defeats President Trump in November. That after Trump stirred controversy by declining to commit to such a transfer. At the White House on Wednesday, a reporter pressed the president on whether he'll accept the results of the election. Trump responded by again questioning the legitimacy of the election with expanded mail-in balloting.
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
People are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transfer of power?
We want to get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi immediately blasted his response.
But that a president of the United States would place in doubt the idea of the peaceful transfer of power is, it's no surprise, again, because the president has been contemptible of science and governance.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell weighed in on Twitter, simply stating, quote, "There will be an orderly transition, just as there has been every 4 years since 1792. On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany sought to clarify the president's remarks.
The president will accept the results of a free and fair election.
But hours later, Trump told reporters once again that he's not sure the election can be honest, with some states mailing millions of unsolicited ballots to voters. He has predicted that will lead to increased voter fraud. The number of Americans filing for unemployment aid rose slightly last week to 870,000. That as the pandemic continues to squeeze employers. And some newly laid off Americans are facing delays in receiving benefits as state agencies are stepping up efforts to combat fraudulent claims. Pennsylvania has found that up to 10,000 inmates are improperly receiving aid. But the Labor Department did state Thursday that the number of people who are continuing to receive unemployment benefits declined to 12.6 million. The steady drop in that figure over several months reflects that some of the unemployed are returning to work. But in other cases, it means workers have exhausted their jobless aid, which lasts 6 months in most states. Another governor has tested positive for the coronavirus.
Right now, I feel fine. No symptoms of any kind. But right now, we just got to take the quarantine procedures in place.
Missouri's Republican Governor Mike Parson announced Wednesday that both he and his wife, Teresa, have COVID-19. A spokeswoman said Teresa Parson had experienced mild symptoms, including a cough and nasal congestion. Governor Parson postponed several events through the remainder of the week. He and his wife had been traveling around the state. A photo posted Tuesday on the governor's Facebook page showed both he and his wife wearing masks in public. Some have criticized the governor for opposing a public mask mandate in Missouri. In Belarus, police have detained hundreds of demonstrators during protests against the country's authoritarian leader. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
Security forces used water cannons to scatter thousands of demonstrators while detaining nearly 400 more people. Dozens were injured in clashes with police. Alexander Lukashenko was unexpectedly sworn into his sixth term as president after an election the opposition says was rigged. Thousands of Belarusians flooded the streets to protest Lukashenko's inauguration, which took place without advance public notice. Belarus's interior ministry said Thursday that police detained 364 people. Most are still jailed, awaiting court hearings. But anti-government rallies continued in Minsk Thursday, despite the crackdown, as hundreds of people chanted and formed human chains in solidarity. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
And I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, feminism and the Supreme Court, plus your listener feedback. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Friday, the 25th of September, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning, I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Megan Basham. What you're hearing is the sound of pallbearers bringing the casket of Ruth Bader Ginsburg into the Supreme Court. Her body lay in repose for 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, for the public and colleagues to pay their respects.
Ruth's passing weighed most heavily on her family, but the court was her family too. This building was her home, too. Of course, she will live on in what she did to improve the law and the lives of all of us. And yet, still, Ruth is gone, and we grieve.
Chief Justice John Roberts delivering a eulogy this week for his colleague.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg's body will lie in state today in the U.S. Capitol, the first time the honor would go to a woman. She died a week ago today, and her life represented not only a string of historic firsts, but also the political ideology of feminism. Justice Ginsburg's brand of feminism included unfailing support for abortion, and she was one of the first nominees to the Supreme Court, if not the only, to state that so plainly. Typically, nominees would try to conceal their views on abortion or say that it was inappropriate for a judge to speak on an issue that might come before the court. Not so, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. This is from her confirmation hearing in the summer of 1993.
It is essential to woman's equality with man that her choice, that she be the decision maker. This is something central to a woman's life, to her dignity, and when government controls that decision for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choices.
She won Senate approval 96-3. Virtually every Republican voted in the affirmative. One of them, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah.
I disagree with you on a number of things, and I'm sure you disagree with me. But that isn't the issue, is it? And frankly, I admire you. You've earned the right, in my opinion, to be on the Supreme Court.
It is highly doubtful her successor will receive the same deference.
You are controversial. Let's start with that.
That's not where Senator Dianne Feinstein ended, though, in her questioning of the woman who seems to be the frontrunner to replace Ginsburg, Federal Appeals Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett. This is from a Senate confirmation hearing 3 years ago.
When you read your speeches, the conclusion one draws is that the dogma lives loudly within you. And that's of concern.
Meaning she seems committed to her faith. Barrett's response.
If you're asking whether I take my faith seriously and I'm a faithful Catholic, I am, although I would stress that my personal church affiliation or my religious belief would not bear on the discharge of my duties as a judge. It's never appropriate for a judge to impose that judge's personal convictions, whether they derive from faith or anywhere else, on the law.
Well, it's Culture Friday, and so let's welcome in Katie McCoy. She's Assistant Professor of Theology and Women's Studies at Southwestern Seminary. Good morning, Katie.
Good morning, Myrna and Megan. How are you both?
Doing well. Thank you so much for being here. Well, of course, we won't find out until tomorrow night President Trump's choice to fill the vacancy left by the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And of course, we don't know for sure whether it's going to be Amy Coney Barrett. But we do know he's committed to a female nominee. And what I think it's safe to assume here is that whoever this president chooses is going to represent a break from the Ginsburg 1960s, 1970s model of feminism. The president's nominee, when she went to law school, will not have faced the same obstacles Ginsburg faced. So she will be following the trail Ginsburg blazed, but it will be someone who probably took a different turn. Now, isn't that a good thing? More choice, not less, including the choice to reject a particular brand of feminism?
Well, you would think so. And in theory, yes. The label feminist historically includes quite a broad swath of different beliefs. Some of the first feminists, like Susan B. Anthony, were against abortion, and they simply wanted legal parity with men, the right to vote, legal protections for victims of domestic abuse, access to education, those types of legal rights. But in the last few years, I've observed something really interesting. There's this rebranding effort among self-identified feminists, and they claim that the whole point of feminism from the beginning was that women would have the choice to be who and what they wanted to be. So if a woman wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, that she had the freedom to choose that. That's really, though, a revisionist history, because historically, especially second wave feminism, women who didn't conform to that kind of party line of what mainstream feminism was saying, they were viewed as repressed, brainwashed into participating in their own oppression. And for that, you only have to look at academic women's studies courses to see that. It's an activistic type of study. It's not really to objectively learn information. It is political in nature. So at the risk of oversimplifying this issue, I think this really all does hinge on the issue of abortion. When it comes to abortion and everything that that industry represents, mainstream feminism is almost militantly exclusionary. You think back to the Women's March of 2017, there were so-called pro-life feminist groups that wanted to be part of it. And they were excluded from being even partners because they were against abortion. So regarding Amy Coney Barrett, we're already seeing just the most nasty attacks, like one major publication comparing her Catholic faith to The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. But you know, it's not just religion in general, right, where we see this kind of vitriol. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's Judaism wasn't a point of contention in her place in the court. So it seems it really does come down to being pro-life in general, but a pro-life Christian in particular. And that vilification of the Christian faith, by the way, and its value of the unborn goes back at least to the 1950s, pre-feminism, when Simone de Beauvoir blamed Christianity for endowing the fetus with a soul. So the fact that abortion was viewed as a moral wrong was essentially Christianity's fault. So pro-life Christianity has historically been incongruent with ideological feminism.
Katie, along those lines, I want to talk a bit about the late Justice Ginsburg's place in history. One of her law clerks wrote, "The life lessons she imparted gave me the courage to take a step back from my own career and choose, for this moment in time, to be more present for my three children." And then Christian singer-songwriter Amy Grant tweeted, "My daughters are growing up in a different world than I did. Thank you, Ruth. We will keep telling your story because you inspire each of us to use our unique gifts, talents, voices to speak truth, love justice, and live humbly." Conversely, now, one of our listeners commented, "No matter how smart, hardworking, and powerful she was, by supporting abortion, she did evil in the sight of the Lord." And then this perspective, "Even if one was bold and steadfast over her career, if her work was at the detriment of the most vulnerable in our society, that work should not be wholly celebrated or revered." So when talking to your students about Justice Ginsburg and her place in history, I'm wondering, what will you say about her?
I'm so glad you brought this up, Myrna, because whether it's the Founding Fathers or particular theologians and now Justice Ginsburg, we all seem very prone in our society today to summarize one's life about one issue. Now, that's not minimizing that one issue at all. It's central to our values as believers, the sanctity of life. But you know, this is where theologically, I think the doctrine of common grace really helps us think through this question. You know, the doctrine of common grace, that God gives grace to the unbeliever who is a cancer researcher to find some type of cure for cancer, and it benefits all of humanity, to the teacher, the university professor, the engineer, someone who contributes to society in a way that benefits all, benefits the whole, uses the mind, the spirit that God gave them for something that is good. And many of the cases, many of the issues that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was advocating for, she was bringing her intellect and skill to overturn policies and practices that were genuinely discriminatory against women. And it's hard to believe that not too long ago, women couldn't get a mortgage or apply for a credit card without a male co-signer. Not all states recognized marital rape as a crime. There were inequitable benefits for women in the military. A woman could lose her job if she were pregnant. So we can look at these disparities that had existed and appreciate Ginsburg's work. They were genuine legal inequities that regarded women as having fewer legal rights than men. But here's what I would want my students to see if I were talking to them. We advocate and affirm the legal equal rights of all people because we are all equal image bearers of our Creator. And that is an inviolable dignity that we have before Him. And therefore, our laws should reflect that. And then that dignity, though, extends to all persons, including the unborn. You mentioned that quote in her Senate confirmation hearing, and when she said that to outlaw abortion means that the government is treating women as less than fully human adults that are responsible. The irony of that, though, is how many other laws do we have where the government controls or at least stipulates what its citizens can and can't do through laws, right? Like, we can't cheat on our taxes. We can't perjure ourselves in court. We can't commit murder. I mean, how is that not the government treating us as less than fully human adults? So certainly in Ginsburg's own rulings, she imposed moral expectations on people. I think it just shows one of the many inconsistencies to pro-abortion arguments and legislation. That being said, I think we can, I think we should appreciate the intellect and skill and contribution of a woman who recognized where something was objectively wrong and worked to correct it. And with that, we can recognize where she fell short of that, where she failed it, and where she perpetuated an injustice against the unborn.
Well, I think that's a good note to end on. Katie McCoy is Assistant Professor of Theology in Women's Studies at Southwestern Seminary. Professor McCoy, thanks so much for being here.
Always great to be with you all.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries. Samaritan members care for one another by praying, encouraging, and sharing healthcare costs, all without the use of insurance. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/world.
something just happened in the music recording industry that hasn't happened in a long time, not since the 1980s. Those of a certain age, and I happen to be one of them, will remember when vinyl records largely gave way to cassette tapes. That was before sales of CDs overtook both cassettes and vinyl. And then, of course, the MP3 came along and, well, you know the rest. But one of those old formats is making a big comeback. It seems many Americans are nostalgic for this sound. For the first time in several decades, vinyl records outsold CDs in the United States. The Recording Industry Association of America reported $232 million in vinyl sales during the first half of 2020. Well, that made up 62% of total physical format revenues. Okay, Megan, what was the first vinyl record you ever bought?
You know what? I have to be honest, Myrna. I don't know that I ever bought a record. No. I bought a lot of cassettes.
Yeah, okay, that's good.
What was yours?
Okay, it was Michael Jackson, 1979, Off the Wall. It was an album.
Oh, well, that's a good one, though.
And I think I still have it. It's The World and Everything in It. Today is Friday, September 25th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Megan Basham. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, a lot of people are getting a kick out of a classic 80s movie reboot. A few years ago, YouTube made a late, rather half-hearted attempt to enter the streaming game. Most of its scripted series were flops, but when it rebooted Karate Kid with the original two stars, whom America had barely heard from in decades, its gamble paid off with a sleeper hit. A Netflix sale soon followed, and since Cobra Kai debuted on that platform last month, well, it's become the most popular show in the country.
What do you think you're doing?
Promoting my business. Why don't you try minding yours?
Minding mine? You know what? Look, this is ridiculous, okay? We can both be adults here. I just don't know why you'd ever want to bring back Cobra Kai after what your sensei did to you.
Because I'm not Kreese. And the lessons worked.
Strike first. No mercy. Real good lessons.
It would be hard to find another 80s update that's even half so clever. We catch up with Johnny Lawrence, the high school bully who inspired 1,000 tousled blonde copycats in middle age. He might have been the big man on campus at 17, but at 50, he spends his days in an alcoholic haze, zoning out on Reagan-era macho movies, trying to block out the fact that his nemesis, Daniel LaRusso, now owns a successful car dealership. About as elegant and introspective as the heavy metal he blares from his cherry Pontiac Firebird, Johnny couldn't be a further cry from Mr. Miyagi. Yet, when a nerdy immigrant teen moves into the rundown apartment next door, Johnny starts to think maybe he does still have something to offer. He decides to resurrect Cobra Kai Dojo.
Because you could stop your training right now and you could walk outside and let the whole world know you're a loser. Or you could plant your feet, look your enemy in the eyes, and punch him in the face!
Living well may be the best revenge, but the Karate Kid isn't content to let his opulent house, beautiful wife, and thriving business speak for themselves. When he gets wind of Johnny's plans, he too decides to return to the ring. And then it's on like Godzilla versus King Kong. Daniel-san isn't the bad guy by a long shot, but he's a lot less lovable than has been Johnny, who makes us laugh out loud with his throwback attitude.
Don't you think you're doing a lot of genderizing?
What?
Sorry. Don't you think you're doing a lot of genderizing, sensei?
No. My guidance counselor says that certain words perpetuate this sexist worldview that could trigger...
Quiet!
From now on, you won't listen to your guidance counselor. You're going to listen to me. Is that understood?
Yes, sensei.
Good. Now stop yapping like a little girl and give me 50 push-ups on your knuckles.
Unlike Daniel, who's the very model of a modern majordomo, Johnny didn't get the memo that it's no longer cool to call women babes or hang massive American flags on his wall. He's today's underdog, a working-class junkyard mutt who gets kicked around by his supposed intellectual and ethical betters, but yet he still has enough spirit to haul himself out of a tangle of greasy sheets every morning and snarl in the face of safe spaces.
We do not train to be merciful here. Mercy is for the weak. Here, on the street, in competition, a man confronts you. He is the enemy. An enemy deserves no mercy. What is the problem, Mr. Diaz?
No problem, Sensei. You punch me. I have asthma, so...
Not anymore. We do not allow weakness in this dojo. So you can leave your asthma and your peanut allergies outside. Is that understood?
Yes, but those are real medical problems. I was... Yes, Sensei, understood.
Later, when someone phones asking if the dojo accepts gender nonconforming students, a confused Johnny wonders if it's some kind of prank call. Is it only nostalgia and weariness with a world that suddenly feels overrun with hall monitors that's won Cobra Kai legions of fans? No doubt that is a significant factor. But the show isn't politically incorrect just for political incorrectness's sake. Cobra Kai weighs what it means to be a man in a culture that no longer seems to have much use for them. It looks at how fathers, both biological and adopted, shape their children, and how growing up without dads is leading to extremes of aggression and helplessness.
Kreese gave me more attention than I ever got at home. The guy was more than a sensei to me. He was basically a father. Yeah, you wouldn't understand.
My dad died when I was 8. Mr. Miyagi was like a father to me. It's crazy, man. Both finding karate role models.
At one point, an athlete at a martial arts competition feels he has to give a virtue-signaling speech condemning toxic masculinity before he can even compete. A viewer can't miss the irony that the woke adults in these young men's lives, well, they demand a conformity and submission far more pitiless than anything a high school clique could come up with. The most frustrating thing about Cobra Kai is that for a series so well-tailored to watch with tweens and teens, it includes a hefty amount of language and crude humor. Thankfully, VidAngel has the show on its service, too. So families have the option to enjoy the fun and thoughtful themes while filtering out what's truly toxic. Today is Friday, September 25th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Next up, listener feedback. And we're going to start today, as we usually do, with corrections. On the September 10th newscast, we told you about the kickoff of the NFL season. That game was between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Houston Texans. That was right. But we told you no fans would attend that evening's game. And that was not correct. In fact, 17,000 people sat in the stands at Arrowhead Stadium.
And in one of our reports about Hurricane Laura coming in Louisiana, we said the storm's winds blew 500 miles inland. Now, that would be pretty far. We actually meant to say 200 miles.
Okay. Well, let's move on now to calls from our listener feedback line. The first is from Andy Sorrentino.
I'm a world member, and I listen in southeastern Pennsylvania. I'm calling with a suggestion for the Legal Docket podcast. How about episodes exploring the justices who make up the Supreme Court? I propose it would be a unique way to round out your season of episodes highlighting court cases. I'm grateful for all the work at World Radio, and thanks for your consideration.
Well, Andy, that is a great suggestion, and we'll consider it for the next season of Legal Docket, because this season is in the books. Well, almost in the books. Our last episode comes out Tuesday.
That's right, just in time for the start of this year's Supreme Court season. And Mary Reichert will, of course, be back to her regular reporting of the oral arguments in every case starting in October. Well, as always, you sent us quite a few emails over the past month. We appreciate every one of you who took the time to write for any reason. Suggestion, reproof, encouragement. Listener Kristen Wolf sent in one of those encouraging notes, and it really made the whole team smile. Kristen said her brother-in-law introduced her to the program and regularly told her about things he'd heard, but she'd never listened for herself until March, when, as she put it, the whole world went crazy. She went on, "I thought that it was time that I start paying attention and staying informed. I've listened to it almost every day since. I've learned so much. I've been encouraged in my walk with the Lord, and I'm always excited to share about the different things that I learn with those around me. Thank you so much. Keep up the good work."
Of course, we also got our fair share of constructive criticism. Listener Susan Blake called in from Lafayette, Indiana. She took issue with our recent report on financial problems in the U.S. Postal Service.
Your reporter listed a lot of the difficult things that the Postal Service faces in meeting budget, et cetera, and he didn't report at all on the kind of benefits postal workers receive, which is just shocking. As a small business owner who has to fund my own health care and who doesn't have anything close to those benefits, it kind of rubbed me the wrong way to see you playing a song about the Postal Service and how they're hurting.
Thank you, Susan, for noting that. It's definitely something to keep in mind for future reports on the Postal Service.
And we also received a fair amount of feedback on Monday's remembrance of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Many of you said you didn't like our focus on her accomplishments rather than her support for abortion. Others said they appreciated our graciousness towards someone we disagree with ideologically.
Yeah, one listener said that after Justice Ginsburg's death, he was convicted that he had not specifically prayed for her salvation. And he thanked us for reminding him to pray that Christ be formed in all our nation's leaders.
Yeah, amen to that.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Well, we're going to end today with a call from listener Jim Berkheimer. He phoned in from Indiana to tell us how much he appreciates the start of each program.
Just wanted to let you know that we really do enjoy listening to the world and everything in it. And I so enjoy the first comments about the people that state their support for world, why they're listening. And that is so neat that you have these people that are doing that. It's fantastic.
Well, we love our listener pre-rolls, too. It's just really fun to hear from people who connect with us from all over the world. This past month, we received messages from listeners in Bangladesh, Japan, and even as far as Sarajevo. Pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And Jim's call couldn't have come in at a better time because we're actually running low on pre-rolls again.
That's right. We asked you several weeks ago to send us recordings of yourself introducing the program. Some of you did, and we're grateful for that. But we still need more. So if you would like to take your turn introducing the program, now's your chance. Go to worldandeverything.org and click on the Engage tab in the top menu. Then select Record a Pre-Roll. You'll find all the instructions there. Oh, and one other note. We love it when families record pre-rolls together, but not when everyone's speaking at the same time. That makes it hard to understand. So by all means, record together, but only one person at a time. Well, it takes a lot of people to put this program together each week. Our thanks now to these hardworking folks. Janie B. Cheney, Kent Covington, Laura Edgehill, Nick Eicher, Kristen Flavin, Kim Henderson, Anna Johansson, Lee Jones, Vivian Jones, Onize Ohikere, Andre Sue Peterson, Bonnie Pritchett, Mary Reichert, Sarah Schweinsberg, and Cal Thomas.
Johnny Franklin and Carl Pete stay up late to get the program to you early. Paul Butler is executive producer. Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief. And, of course, you. You make this program possible with your support, and we thank you. Psalm 119 tells us that those who seek the Lord's precepts will walk in freedom. May you have a restful weekend and worship with your brothers and sisters in Christ.